So, on this good morning, we continue reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, the fourth canto. And we're in the middle of the story of King Puranjana, which Narada Muni, as you may remember, was telling to Prachina Parishat, a great king. And so, today we're at verse 49. Mukhya Nama. Let's see. Mukhya Nama Purastadvas. Dayaparna Bahudano. Vishayo Yati Pururat. Rasagya Viparnanvita. The fifth gate, situated on the eastern side, was named Mukhya, or the chief. Through this gate, accompanied by his friends named Rasagya and Viparna, he used to visit two places named Bahudana and Aparna. Purport. The mouth is here described as the chief, or the most important gate. The mouth is a very important entrance because one has two functions to conduct with the mouth. One function is eating, and the other is speaking. Our eating is done with the friend Rasagya, the tongue, which can taste so many different types of foods. The tongue is also used for speaking, and it can speak of either material sense enjoyment or Vedic knowledge. Of course, here material sense enjoyment is stressed. Therefore, the word Rasagya is used. Mukhya Nama Purastadvas Dayaparna Bahudano Vishayau Yati Pururat Rasagya Viparnanvitaha. The chief gate situated on the eastern side was named Mukhya, or the chief. Through this gate, accompanied by his friends named Rasagya and Viparna, he used to visit two places named Bahudana and Aparna. Om Jnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namah Mukham Karoti Vachalam Pangum Langayate Girim Yat Kripa Tamaham Vande Shri Gurum Dinatarinam. We read the Bhagavatam every morning very slowly. We go forward one verse at a time. And when we get to sections like this, I get the feeling a lot of devotees, especially the speakers, are not really happy about that. Because the Bhagavatam moves very slowly, verse by verse. And in these verses, we have, of course, the description of King Puranjana, and which is this allegorical narration that Narada Muni was telling about this king who's living in this city of nine gates and has this queen and has all his attendants and so on. And you get this story, and one by one, one verse at a time, we see one of the senses. Yesterday we had, what sense did we have yesterday? The nose. Tomorrow and the day after tomorrow, we'll have the ears. And so we move very, very slowly through them. And one might wonder and think, well, why don't we do this more quickly? Why don't we speed up a little bit in this? Sometimes the speaker is a bit courageous and says, okay, now I'll cover five verses in a time. And everyone is relieved and everyone goes, oh, good, you know, we're moving on through this section. But actually, it is important we slow down a bit and look at each verse at a time, especially in this section. The story of Puranjana with all these technical names, here we have Mukhya and Aparna and Bahudana and Rasagya and Viparna, and we have all these technical terms, and one might think this has very little to do with me. This has this sort of, I can't relate to this, this is too abstract, this is too alien for me. But actually, as Prabhupada mentions in the very beginning of this chapter, he says Puranjana is everyone. Everyone is a Puranjana. And so this story reflects our own experience. And while we go through this section here, now that we are on the senses, it's sort of an opportunity for us to reflect one sense at a time, one day at a time, how we're bound by these senses, and how these senses can degrade us or uplift us, and how these senses influence us. We're not this body, but we have a body. And we inhabit the body. We're a Puranjana. We're somebody that lives in the city of the body. And so these senses affect us. And this story is told by Narada Muni to show exactly how these senses affect us. So today we're looking at the fifth of those, the fifth gate, namely the mouth and the senses associated with the mouth. And it's sort of, you can come to a Srimad Bhagavatam class in two ways. You can come passively and just sort of sit in the class and sort of wonder what's going to happen and sort of just let this, the words of the speaker roll over you. But you can also come actively and say, I'm going to look at this verse and see what teachings this verse has that I can apply today. So today I invite you all to reflect on the senses associated with the mouth, as Prabhupada says, taste and speech, and see how they affect us and how they how we're bound by them and how we can be liberated by them. So this is the fifth gate, and it is called Mukhya. Mukhya, of course, means that which is related to the mouth, but it also means the chief. And Prabhupada emphasizes this here. He says, this is the chief of the gates. Because why is this the chief? Because there's two senses associated with it. If you look at all the other gates, all the other openings in our body, there's one sense associated with. We have the ears, which have the sense of hearing associated with. We have the eyes, the sense of seeing is associated with that. But for the mouth, there's two senses. We have the sense of taste, which is done with rasagya, with the knower of rasa, namely the tongue, who can enjoy. Rasa means juice or flavor. So it's the tongue knows a tasty thing. But we also have the other sense, and that is a sense of speech. And there are two very different senses. One is a sense of I hope you know these distinctions. One is a jnanendriya. The sense of taste is a jnanendriya. It's a sense that is meant to acquire knowledge. It's with the taste we experience the world around us. Like with seeing, we get information about the world around us. But speech is a different sense. It is a karmendriya. It is a sense of action. With speech, we interact with the world. We don't gain information from the world, but we interact with it, and we can change the world, and we can sort of manipulate the world around us. So there are two very different senses. One is that sort of goes inwards, if you want. The sense of taste goes inwards. We get information from outside. The sense of speech goes outwards. Something comes out. And of course, growing up in a Christian country, many of you might be familiar with the famous statement of Paul, the sort of, in some sense, the father of Christianity in the New Testament, who said famously that it is not that which goes into the body that pollutes the body, but it's that which comes out. It's not that which goes into the mouth that pollutes the body, but it's that which goes out. And he was, of course, reacting against the whole Jewish culture. Remember, Jesus was basically a Jew. And the Jewish culture has a lot of regulations on regarding eating. And so he got rid of that and said, no, this is not, we're not Jewish. We don't care so much about food regulations, but we care about ethics and moral behavior. And therefore what comes out, speech, is more important than what goes in, namely eating. But of course, we beg to differ. We have a different understanding. And we understand that what comes in the body will affect what goes out the body. What comes into the body does have an effect. It's sort of what you eat builds your body. You know, and it's sort of, if you eat healthy food, you'll more likely have a healthy body. If you eat junk food, you'll have bad health and so on. But it also feeds the subtle body. It feeds the mind. It builds the mind. And it builds the intellect and so on. It builds us it builds our entire body. And therefore you see in Hindu culture, there's a lot of regulations on eating. There's certain people cannot eat with certain people. If you're a Brahmin, you cannot eat or accept food from somebody of a lower caste and so on. And similar to Paul, Mahatma Gandhi, he didn't like this very much. And he said, Hinduism is a kitchen religion. And he meant that in a negative way. He said, it's a kitchen religion. They're only concerned with all these very complex rules about what you can eat, what you cannot eat, with who you can eat and with who you cannot eat. But he said, we have to take it away from that. And we have to go to what it's actually all about, namely ethics and loving God and all these, and truth, not just all these regulations that apply to the kitchen. But again, of course, we see Prabhupada used this phrase, kitchen religion, and whereas for Gandhi this was a negative thing, for Prabhupada this was a positive thing, and Prabhupada would often say, yes, we are the kitchen religion. For us, we worship God in the kitchen, and it's a glorious thing. It is not something to look down on, but it's something to celebrate. And it's sort of it's a very profound concept, actually. Very few religious traditions have this idea, where we say "Ishavasyam idam sarvam yat kinchit yam jagat yam jagat," that everything in this world is pervaded by the Lord and is owned by the Lord, and therefore tena tyaktena bhunjita, one should bhunjita, one should enjoy, one should bhunjita also means to eat, one should eat what is set aside for oneself. Magritha kasya svidhanam, and one should not accept things. Kasya svidhanam, for whose is wealth? To whom does wealth belong? And as Prabhupada says, we should knowing well to whom it belongs. Everything belongs to Isha, to the Lord. And Prabhupada, of course, explains in his commentary on the Isha Upanishad that tena tyaktena bhunjita, what is set aside for us as humans is vegetarian food. But then he says, actually, that's also not so important. But what's really important is you understand the first part, Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam, everything is owned by the Lord. And if you understand that, then you're not just a vegetarian, but you will offer everything back to the Lord. And everything you do, from the minutest act in your life to the biggest project you engage on, will be done with a spirit of inner renunciation, knowing well to whom everything belongs, and with a spirit of sacrifice. So for us, we worship the Lord, but we worship the Lord not just in the temple, not just in front of the altar, not just in the morning services we have here, but we worship God in every minute aspect of our life, even when it comes to eating. And it's sort of eating is one of those things that it's one of our bodily necessities. We have to eat. But even those very small things or those bare essentials of life become spiritualized, become spiritual practice, become a worship of Krishna. So this is when it comes to the sense of taste. This is what we're trying to do. We try to avoid bad food, like Prabhupada says in the Isha Upanishad. We tena tyaktena bhunjita, what is set aside for human beings is vegetarian food. The meat and so on is for animals like the tiger. We don't accept those things. So we restrict our eating, but more than that, we turn it into worship and we turn it into praise of Krishna. And therefore, we offer something to the Lord and we eat tena tyaktena bhunjita, that which is left behind by the Lord, that which is being set aside by the Lord. Namely, when we offer the food, the Lord leaves the food behind. So that is what we eat. That is what we honor. This gate of the mouth is said to be the chief, because it has not just a sense of taste, but more importantly, it has also the sense of speech. And speech is a very difficult sense, and it's one that we often don't really reflect on much. But if you read through the Bhagavatam, it is a very important thing. There's three things we're said to serve the Lord with. We should serve the Lord with, and we should surrender to the Lord. They're the body, the mind, and speech. They're three different. They're differentiated. Although speech, in a sense, is part of the body, it's one of the senses, and therefore it's part of the body. It's separated. It's given special importance. We should serve the Lord with body, mind, and speech, and this sense is the chief, because Prabhupada explains that if we control this, we can control all the other urges of the senses. As you probably remember from your reading of Nectar of Devotion, Nectar of Instruction, the first verse, Vacho Vegam, Manasa Krodha Vegam, Jihva Vegam. You have two already there. You have Vacho Vegam and Jihva Vegam, the urge of speech and the urge of the tongue. They're both there. And Prabhupada explains if you can control the tongue with its two aspects, namely speaking and tasting, you can control all the other urges that we experience. So therefore, we should offer our food and we should eat in a spirit of sacrifice and live and sort of nourish ourselves in the spirit of sacrifice and this inner renunciation. And we should curb our speech. If you go through the Bhagavatam, you'll see throughout the Bhagavatam it's mentioned that great devotees curb their speech, control their speech, or you have this expression, measure their speech. And this is what we have to do. This is what we have to learn. And it's a very difficult practice because many of us experience this, that it's easy to just talk and talk and chatter and not really think of what comes out the body. But we have to remember that just as Paul said, that which goes into the body, he says, that doesn't pollute the body, but that which goes out the body pollutes the body. And we disagree with the first half. We say, no, that which comes into the body also pollutes the body. But we do agree with the second half, that which comes out the body pollutes the body. Speech is a very important sense. It said that a fool cannot be detected unless he speaks. And if you remember Krishna, Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, he asks, Sita Pragyasha Kabhasha. He asked the characteristics of a Sthita Pragya, somebody whose intelligence is fixed, somebody who's fixed on the spiritual path and regulated in his spiritual behavior. And what's the first thing he asks is, what is his speech? That's the first thing Arjuna asked. And then later in the same verse, he says, the next one. Yeah, Kim Prabhasheta. And how does he speak? What is his speech? What is his language? And how does he speak? So again, we see the importance given to this, to speech and what we say and what comes out of the body. Krishna in the Gita gives us guidelines of how to do this, how to regulate our speech. It is very difficult, but he gives a simple list of things we have to be aware of. And when we do that, it's easy to reflect on what you say, whether it falls in that category or not, whether it's something we should give up or not. And he says in the 17th chapter, he talks about the austerities of speech. And he says, Anudvega karam vakyam, satyam priyahitam chayat, swadhyaya abhyasanam chayva, vangmayam tapa uchate. The vangmaya tapa, the austerity of speech consists of anudvega karam vakyam, of utterances, of sayings which are anudvega karam, which do not upset others, which do not cause you have the same anudvega, which do not cause agitation in others. That's the austerity. That's the first thing of austerity of speech. So our speech should not agitate others, and which means that it's easy to say something that it's very easy to upset other people. I don't know if you've experienced this. You often just need a little word, and it's generally a word that is carelessly said, sort of not really considering the other person's feelings, or it is a word sometimes that is said with very malicious intent, where you intentionally want to upset someone because you don't like them or because they've hurt you in the past or something like that. But Krishna says, no, austerity of speech is anudvega karam vakyam. You should not speak in such a way that it upset others. Prabhupada explains that the teacher may speak in such a way that it upsets his students. That's all right, because he's the teacher and he's responsible for their education. But he cannot do this with people that are not his students. And we see this in Prabhupada himself. Prabhupada was often very forceful in his speech. When talking in lectures or speaking to his disciples, he was quite shocking sometimes in the things he said. He was a very strong preacher. But when he deals with people that were not his students, or that didn't, where he considered that they would not become his students either, he was very gentle and very friendly and very kind. If you read if you listen to the conversations Prabhupada had with visitors that came to him, he was a very perfect gentleman with them. He would not upset them. He would just deal with them nicely. So, anudvega karam vakyam satyam. And the second part is we should be truthful. Everything we say should be truthful. It's easy to tell lies again, and we tell lies all the time. And we say, well, they're just a little thing, and it's sort of convenient. Generally, they're convenient for us. They make us look better, or they cause us less inconvenience. If I would tell the truth to this person, then perhaps, you know, I'd have to do X, Y, and Z, or that person will think, you know, this of me. So I'll just tell a little lie. And we do it so easily without considering it. But we should remember, what is the last leg of dharma? Dharma has four legs. Three of them are broken. One of them is remaining in Kali Yuga, and that is satya. That is truthfulness, and that is what we should maintain. And of course, satya goes much deeper than that. As we know from Satsarup Maharaj wrote this very nice book years and years ago, Truthfulness, the Last Leg of Religion, where he goes through this and he looks at satya, and he points out that satya really means, truthfulness means acknowledging the existence of the absolute truth. So it's beyond just mere telling lies. It's really raising ourselves to a spiritual platform and recognizing the existence of Krishna and adjusting our lives to that. So our speech should also reflect that. Satyam priyahitam chayat. And it should be speech which is priya, which is pleasant, and which is hita, which is beneficial. Gossip is generally not beneficial. And it's again something we fall into so easily. When you see someone, a friend of yours that lives in another place, as many of our friends are, and we haven't seen them for a long time, and we see them, one of the things we often ask is, so how is such and such doing? And how is such and such doing? And is this person still in the temple there? And how about them? And then we want to know all the details, and we engage in gossip. But is it really hitta? Is it really beneficial? Is this really benefiting us in any way? Or is it just sort of satisfying our curiosity and our perhaps we might even have a sense of superiority that when we see some things that are going bad, we think at least I'm doing good. You know, I'm sort of okay. So one should reflect on that. Why are we talking so much? Why are we reflecting on all these issues? Of course, the sense of speech is very difficult to control. If you try to do it, you'll realize this. If you keep this verse in mind of Krishna, of these austerities of speech, and it's a good verse to remember. And just when you speak, sometimes you'll catch yourself and say, "Oh, this is causing agitation in others, what I'm saying now. Or this is actually not really hitta, this is not really beneficial, or this is not pleasing, or this is not truthful." And then you get this inner reflection on it, and then you start seeing how much of that you actually, how little of austerity of speech you practice, and how far you still have to go. And it's really, speech comes, of course, is fueled by the other two. As I mentioned, you have body, mind, and speech. Those three you should surrender. And with those three you should serve the Lord. But they all influence each other, of course. The way you act will affect the way you think and the way you speak and the other way around. They all sort of mutually influence each other. And we see this in the next verse in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna talks about the austerities of mind. And one of them is very relevant to us here. One of the austerities of mind is maunam, is silence, which we would generally associate with speech. But Krishna says, no, this is an austerity of mind. Being able to not speak, to be silent, is an austerity of the mind. It means you have to have this self-control to not speak. And maunam is something we don't talk much about. But Prabhupada says maunam is very important. Mauna, silence, means you're serious about spiritual life, Prabhupada says. It means you're always thinking of self-realization, which means you look more inwards than outwards. You speak less, but you reflect more. That is what mauna is about. And in the devotee in this 26 list of 26 qualities of a Vaishnava, one of them is he's silent. And in the 12th chapter, again, Krishna says at the end of the 12th chapter, my devotee is a mauni, is a silent person. And Prabhupada explains there that by practicing silence, one can make advancement very quickly, very rapidly. So silence is actually very important. We should curb our speech and we should practice silence. And sometimes if you don't, if what you're going to say is not going to sort of fall within that category of austerity of speech, why not stay silent? And why not just refrain from it and reflect inwards and be serious about self-realization? But of course, we're not just about curbing the senses and denying the senses. That's not our path. That is an important aspect of our path. We do this, but we don't just do this. And more than that is we embrace our senses and we celebrate Krishna with our senses. Just as with the tongue, with the sense of taste, we don't just, you know, eat stale food or something like that and say, well, I'm not going to enjoy this because the enjoyment will bind me. But we offer nice food to Krishna and we relish that food, we taste that food that is offered to him as the prasada, as the grace of the Lord. So in the same way with the other senses too. And if you read through our scriptures, you see this all the time, how our path is really a celebration of Krishna with our senses. Krishna is a feast for the eyes. We relish hearing about Krishna's qualities. We relish Krishna prasada. We embrace our senses and use them all in the service of the Lord. And we worship by our relishing Krishna. Krishna is honored and Krishna is praised. And so, with speech, the same thing. We should not just not speak beneficial, or speak words that are beneficial and truthful and so on, but swadhyaya bhyasanam chaiva. We should practice recitation of scripture, which means we should glorify the Lord. That is the proper use of our speech. And so it's an aspiration we can have. You have this beautiful verse that I think Pujaris used this. I'm not sure. Stitir seva gatir yatra smritish chinta stutir vacha. Let my stiti, my situation, my normal situation be seva. Let my walking be pilgrimage. Let my thoughts be remembrance of you, and let my words be words of praise. It's a verse from the Hari Bhakti Vilas. It's a very beautiful verse. So this is our aspiration, that we curb our speech and we practice the austerity of speech. But more important than that, we pray to the Lord that our speech may be the words we utter may be words of praise. And then, we can only do this, of course, when we invite the Lord in our life and when we worship the Lord. And I'll just close with this very beautiful verse that I end up quoting every time I give a Bhagavatam class here. But it's such a nice verse that why not? It's a verse from Prithu Maharaj in his prayers to the Lord, where he says, Sa uttama shloka mahan mukachito bhavat padam bhoja sudakananila smritir punavismrita tattva vartmanam kuyogi namno vitaratyalam varai. He's saying that he's asking the Lord for the benediction to hear from the narrations of his great pastimes by his devotees. And why? Because he says, in the heart of your devotees, you are situated. So when they speak, the words that come out of their mouth, the wind, if you want, that comes out of their mouth, has blown over the lotus feet of the Lord that is within their heart and carries the pollen of the Lord's lotus feet. And that pollen has the ability to revive the memory of those who have forgotten the path. So this is our aspiration. We want to become like that. We want to become like these mahats, these great devotees, where we have the Lord in the heart, and when we speak, our speech carries the fragrance of the Lord's lotus feet. And that has a much nicer effect than all the nasty speech that is harsh, that is not beneficial, that is not truthful, that is not that is causing agitation in others. So this is our aspiration. So today we can pray for this and say, oh Lord, please make my words carry the fragrance of your lotus feet. Please let me remember you in my heart, and then when I speak, let my words be beneficial to others and remember myself and others of the path back to you. So I know I'm over time, so I'll end here. I don't know if you all want to rush out or read the Chaitanya Purana. I think there's better things the person can do in such a situation than go to the person that has wronged, that he feels has wronged him or has hurt him, and speak what's on his mind, and just, because what will come out will be sort of possibly agitating, not beneficial, and so on. And there's other sort of ways out, one of which might be to talk to somebody else who might be able to mediate between others, because the thing is, if you have two people that have a disagreement or an argument, generally the ego kicks in, and so one person says something coming from sort of false ego, and the other person is hurt by that because of false ego. So when that person is going to sort of retaliate or say something back or respond to that, it will be from the false ego, and then this person will respond again from that platform, and sort of it will just go back and forth. Whereas if you have a person in the middle who's a bit more, is sort of less involved in the situation, and who sort of is detached from the situation, he can deflect things, and he can sort of hold a mirror in front of people and say, well, this is what you're saying, is this really what you want, and he can mediate the situation. I think that's possibly a better solution to problems than otherwise we're like I don't know if you've ever when I was a kid, you know, we used to have chickens, and those chickens lay eggs, and then you get, you know, little chicks, and a lot of them were male chickens. And so at some point every year we would have like several cocks running around, and they always fight with each other. And it's sort of one picks on the other, and then the other picks back, and they're just fighting the whole day. So we can easily become like that. We can become sort of fighting animals with our speech, where we just throw words back and forth, and sort of no solution is really there. The only way the fight would stop with these cocks was if we took one away, and there was only one left, and then it would be fine. So in the same way, of course, we're more than animals, so we hopefully can deal with situations like that better by placing someone who's a bit more aloof from the situation in the middle that can mediate between them. I don't know if that satisfies. Of course, I do not know, and I do not have the arrogance to claim I do, to know Prabhupada's mind. But the impression I get is that Prabhupada was could see certain persons that they may not be his sort of formal students, but they had a student attitude, and then Prabhupada would deal with them in such a way. Sometimes, of course, he just had debates too, which is sort of a different level of speech. It's interesting, the Bhagavatam also has something to say about that with debates. In the 11th canto, it said that great devotees should not engage in shushka vada vivad, should not engage in dry or sort of useless debates. Krishna says they should not be logicians, and they should not engage in useless debates. So that's we shouldn't just uselessly debate. But Prabhupada, there are proper debates as well, and in proper debates you can be more forceful. So we see sometimes, like Prabhupada with this cardinal in France, what's his name? He was having a debate. That was a debate he was having, and in a debate you can be more forceful, and that's the nature of those things. But in normal conversation, when you see when he was talking, if he would speak with Christians, for example, and there's all these conversations he had with Jesuits or Carmelite nuns and so on, he'd be very polite, because he would see they're not my students here, and he would not be very heavy with them, and he would generally not say you're a rascal. Because they were also not debates, they were just conversations he was having. So perhaps that's sort of part of it, I don't know. You probably know better than I do. So, okay. There's a difference between inquiring for somebody's welfare and being genuinely concerned with some. Like if I haven't heard from a friend in a long time, and somebody comes from the place where that friend lives, and I'm eager to know how my friend is doing because I'm concerned for his or for his welfare, and so I ask about that, and that I would say is fine. But when it goes beyond that, and it goes that to people I don't really have such a close connection with, but that I know and they live there, and when I start asking about them just to know how things are going there, perhaps that's more going into the realm of gossip, because I'm not really concerned about them. I'm just curious and I just want to know, and I might want to know because I have an opinion on something, or I might want to see certain things fulfilled that I thought, I thought it was going to go that way with that person, and now you've confirmed this. So that is more the realm of gossip, where there is no real concern with them. It's very interesting. Kierkegaard, the existentialist philosopher, the Danish fellow, he considered the biggest the sort of the evil thing that modern world had brought that would bring the downfall of Western civilization, he said, is newspapers. And he says newspapers are dangerous because they create a curiosity in people to know about everything and to have an opinion about everything, and to communicate their opinion about everything to everyone. But it doesn't inspire people to act. It's just people will talk and talk and talk and have opinions about things, but they won't actually act and they won't actually make the world a better place. They just talk about how bad the world is and how bad things are going, but they won't actually make the move to do something positive. And he said this is the danger of the newspapers. And nowadays, of course, we have the internet, which is even worse. Which is, you can be informed about so many things and have an opinion about everything, and yet it doesn't inspire us to actually do something. And we see that you have all these online things where people just talk and talk and talk. And what are they doing? Often they're not doing very much. And this is, I'm not just talking about devotees, I'm talking about the world in general. And it's just we like to talk and have an opinion about everything, but not actually do something. And that is what gossip is. We like to know things and have opinions and form opinions about things without actually being. If I ask about the welfare of a friend, I'm concerned about the friend. So if something is not going well with the friend, I will act and I will see if I can do something for my friend. Or if something is going well, I might send him home. I'm glad to hear everything is going fine. There's action that comes from it. From just gossip, nothing happens. You just talk and form an opinion about things. So that's a distinction I would make. Okay, last one.
Could you tell me which verse it is about the sharing of speech?
17. No, Bhagavad Gita. 17 chapter. It says you have austerity of the body. Krishna's talk, it's, you know, he's going through all these things and analyzing them according to the three modes of material nature. And then he comes to tapas, to austerity. And he talks about austerity in the three modes. And then he says there's austerity of the body, there's austerity of speech, and there's austerity of mind. So they're somewhere towards the end of the 17th chapter. You should be able to find it relatively easily if you pick up a book. And so, okay, I won't keep you any longer from your breakfast, so we can worship the Lord with our tongue. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.